Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
It is October, and it's time for another episode of The Three Horsemen. Hello, everybody. This is our approach to Halloween, and once again, I am joined by my illustrious co-host. Say hello, John Stevens.
Hello. My name is John Stevens, which is clear since I'm the one answering now. I am a columnist for SF Signal who is currently on hiatus, but should be back shortly to writing again. And you can also find me on Twitter at Erudite Ogre, where I say a lot of really dumb things.
Nonsense. Who told you that? Don't listen to them. I don't care what they say about you. So.
Thanks.
Good evening, Fred Kish.
Good evening. I'm not sure if I'm illustrious or not, but I am certainly voluminous. I can be found online. My blog is Bernal, Bernal Alpha, and I am on Twitter all the time. And now I'm on LO, and I'm on app.net, but not really because I can't figure out how to work it. And G+, and maybe even Facebook or whatever.
I think this is becoming a problem, Fred. I really think you got to step back and let us do an intervention.
That could be.
Okay. And we are joined this evening by Mr. David Annandale.
Hello there.
David approaches horror from a number of angles of approach. He does some writing and he does some teaching about them fancy movie things. And I'm very happy to have him on so we can discuss things of a horrific and Halloween-y nature. David, tell people about yourself and what you've got coming up, what you're doing lately, etc.
Well, most of the writing is for the Black Library, so lots of Warhammer 40,000 stuff and some Horus Heresy. I'm currently working on the second Yarik novel, so that should be coming out next year. And there's some various other shorts of Yarik and Grey Knights and things coming down the road. I'm also the author of the haunted house, the horror novel Gethsemane Hall. With Black Library. This year, the books have been Yarik, Imperial Creed, Overfiend, The Damnation of Pythos, which is the horror novel, the Horus Heresy novel, the Grey Knights novel Maledictus. Yeah. And
it is a horror, but not a horror novel.
Well, what's been really great about working with Black Library is that they've not only tolerated my tendencies towards horror, they've actively enabled me. Damnation of Pythos is probably the closest thing I've written so far to a full-on horror novel for Black Library. And then most recently, Lamarty's Guardian of the Lost has just become is being released as part of a reward point reward on the Black Library site, at least for the first edition of the book. And then outside of that, Gethsemane Hall is my haunted house novel. I've written the Jen Blaylock series of thrillers, and at the University of Manitoba, I teach film, English literature, and creative writing. And I'm one of the many co-hosts at your bitter enemy, the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
It's funny that you mentioned that about Black Library. Was what you were producing for them a bit of a surprise for them when it came to the horrific element, or?
I don't know that it was. Well, probably not, because the first story that I wrote for them, The Carrion Anthem, had definite horrific aspects to it. Well, I realize I sort of hit some of your buttons with that, with the whole sound thing you were telling me once. So it's always been there. They've encouraged me to keep pushing it. And a lot of the projects I've been doing for them have skewed that way. The opportunity is there in the types of horror, the types of novel, a lot of Freudian slips tonight, that I've been doing for them leads very naturally into the more horrific.
Yeah, because it's certainly a franchise that lends itself to that.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's one stop shopping for me as far as like all the genres I love, genre for lack of a better word, but everything in one place. This fusion of horror and science fiction and military and so it can go in so many different directions, right? So it can. It's a universe that can encompass the more humorous work of Sandy Mitchell, or me going as black as I like.
Hmm.
It's brutally campy.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly this awareness of it, right? It's also extremely operatic, which is what I love. I mean, I've always had this tendency to go over the top, and here's I'm writing something. Oh man, this is way too much, too over the top. I wonder if they'll let me get away with it. And they're like, yeah, do that more. Okay, yes. which is I don't know how healthy it is for me, but I revel in it. And there is this awareness certainly that surrounds it, that high camp. I mean, particularly in the if you look at like the Orc Codex. Which are hilarious. Mm-hmm. I think this is really important for the in the stories themselves. There's not a kind of winking camp aspect to it. It's still played straight and going for the there are some of the more deliberately humorous stories, but for the most part, it's done straight, going for the gusto, going for the horror.
It's totally reveled in.
Yeah, and but the, totally in this framework, right? That if you consider the human the Imperium and the absolutely rampaging xenophobia of the of all of the characters there, right? The this kind of human exceptionalism which is of course played up very explicitly. So. And presented in that the opening that introduction that is there in every book, letting you know this is the dystopia to end all dystopias, the most horrific regime ever conceived of, and so all of the heroism that you encounter is colored by this knowledge the Empire in Star Wars would go, oh man, you guys are way too dark. it's like one might want to raise some issues regarding human rights, there's that knowingness, and I think it's at least for coming from the Canadian position, sort of outside both of the other dominant English speaking cultures, it's a conception that strikes me as being quintessentially British. There's this lost empire aspect to it. Rather than everything's going to turn out great, it's everything's going to crap. And what seemed to be great in the past really wasn't. So I don't know. And that may be a completely false impression on my part, but it's something that has certainly struck me for a long time and one of the things that I find delightful about it.
Mm. Yeah, it's so weird to bring that up. I remember when they tried to they released that Star Wars novel a few years ago, which was their attempt at doing a straight up horror book. Called like Blood Troopers or something, like Death Troopers or something. It was one of those things that I said, okay, this is the same universe that gave us, Ewok Adventures and stuff like that. They're trying to do a Doctor Who. They're trying to give us this whole spectrum of the lightest Sarah Jane adventure all the way up to the blackest Torchwood type mutilation and carnage that tends to, run rampant and kind of shove it all into one continuity. Mm-hmm. I just find it funny when people try to do that. Well, this is October and we are approaching Halloween, and I have had horror on my mind a lot lately. A few weeks ago or last month when I did the SF Signal podcast, I talked about Kathy Koja quite a bit, and I started going to my head, I started thinking about, you know, how much I really enjoyed horror in the 90s. I used to read a lot of it. I read it pretty voraciously. And it kind of occurred to me that I had not been reading as much. I've read, you know, a lot of the recent anthologies, you know, Fearful Symmetries, and I think this was the first year I read a year's best horror in a while. And I've been reading Black Static. But I kind of started looking around and seeing exactly what was going on in the horror field, primarily in short fiction. I was very happy to see that a lot of guys that I really like Steve Rancic Tem and Brian Hodge, were still putting stories out. And so I started getting back into it. And the more I thought about it, what kind of came through my mind was I was reading part of the New Weird anthology that had come out a few years back. And as I was reading it, I was saying to myself, you know, I'm seeing a lot of the fossil footprint of splatterpunk from the 90s kind of on this stuff. It's not mm-hmm. so much that it's a different take or a mutation of it, but it's definitely there. It's definitely part of the ongoing DNA of horror. And then I started thinking about American Elsewhere by Robert Jackson Bennett, which struck me as almost a Brian Lumley book in the way it approached, you know, some of the tropes that it did. So what's been going through my mind is basically, where is horror now? And in my mind, the 90s had a huge influence, but it's not something that really seems to get discussed all that much. And I'm wondering, am I crazy, or did this really happen? Or is horror now actually carrying part of that banner continually? Or
my memory of the 90s is a very, very dark time for horror. The splatterpunk movement being in some ways, I mean, I may be getting a little bit fuzzy on some of my chronology, but it felt like one of the last gasps before the terrible implosion. There was the big boom in the 80s, right? Or end of the 70s right. and the 80s, and it was the golden age of the die-cut double cover paperback. And then in the 90s, it just collapsed. I remember bookstores got rid of their horror sections altogether. It was one of the reasons why my first novels that of mine are thrillers rather than horror. Horror was my first love, but I couldn't get myself arrested. It was such a dismal time that I'd been reading a lot of thrillers and enjoying them. I thought, okay, I'm going to try writing one of these. And the same thing with horror films. I was trying to go to every horror movie that I could in the theaters just to support them, but that meant going to see things like Candyman 2. Mm-hmm. There was just so little until, I mean, there was a sign of a revival beginning to happen late 90s with Scream, and then boom, we came back big time in 1999 with Blair Witch Project, Stir of Echoes, The Sixth Sense, The Haunting of Hill House, House on Haunted Hill, and the ill-advised Haunting remake, and so on and so on and so forth, right? Like, it came back in a big way in the theaters. In publishing, the revival has been considerably more tentative, but it's been there. Something came back, and we do have seen the proliferation of smaller specialty presses like Dark Fuse and so forth, or Sam Hain moving into horror as well. So this stuff is there, and I think I think the influences are certainly there from the splatterpunks around, but all sorts of other. I mean, I think the history, it is a genre like, well, I want to retract that. I'd prefer not to call it a genre, but it is a form that is very conscious of its history, I guess, like some of the other elements of the fantastic. And so the traces of splatterpunk along with the more Lovecraftian and even look at some of the classic ghost stories. If you look at the success of like some of Susan Hill's earlier works coming back into print and the attention that she's been getting and some of the ghost stories around and some of the stuff that she's been doing. So there's all these different threads that are out there, I guess, right?
I'd comment on one thing. I talking to the three of us on a regular basis, I think there's a lot of science fiction that isn't really aware of where it came from these days. But that's that's just us. Yeah, something that went through my mind while you were saying that was that, you know, I mean, Clive Barker, who was certainly a big name in the field, has seemed to have moved himself back towards horror now, which is something I don't want to say he was avoiding, but he was certainly playing a lot more with the dark fantasy and the gothic stuff, as opposed to the more, you know, visceral existential stuff that he was doing, you know,
early in his
career. And I think the fact that he dove back into comics as hard as he did injected quite a bit of life into the Hellraiser franchise with the comics he was doing. I mean, he brought them back hard, and they got kind of crazy, and he did a lot of real game-changing stuff with the franchise that made me go, wow, if a creator is willing to go that far with his creation, good for him. Maybe things are not as bleak as I think they are.
I was just going to say, in comics, it just seemed to be a lot, and even to a degree, television, in a way that is relatively new. I mean, well, I'd have to qualify that in all kinds of ways.
Well, yeah, it's odd that you say that, because the other thing that went through my mind is that how easily both SF and fantasy have lifted horror tropes. You know, aside from the old monster on a spaceship type thing, we're now seeing that level of dread running through so much. In fact, it was funny because when I wrote the notes for doing this episode, one of the things that I had mentioned was that, you know, a monster or a big terrible thing tends to be a mainstay when it comes to a lot of fantasy, certainly urban fantasy, and in a lot of even some of the epic stuff, there tends to be this great big dreaded horrible thing which is going to end up, you know, encountering our heroes during the course of it. And I thought about the current aspect of that trope as opposed to the fact that, like, Conan used to fight a big stompy monster, and that really doesn't happen anymore. And that was the thought I had. And then the next day I finished reading City of Stairs, which has a big stompy monster in it, which comes up out of the river. So maybe I'm overreacting at a certain
extent. I'd say that extent. China Mieville, would you say he's kind of splatter fantasy, or whatever we want to call it?
Well, I think, you know, once again, I think there's certainly some of the aspects that are there.
Yeah.
What always struck me about his work is that, and this is where I think the carryover from splatterpunk comes. It's and how it intersects with quote unquote the new weird is that the horror aspect of it is not necessarily something that is lurking in the shadows. It tends to just be running in the background. It's an accepted, not necessarily accepted, but it's an existent part that everybody is at least aware of. I see that in more and more current horror stories. One of the books that John recommended to me a while, oh God, I can't think of it now. As I was reading it, I was like, wow, this is the running through the background here. They've got basically, you know, they can't supply an actual spooky string soundscape in the background of this book, but they give you certainly the window dressing of a lot of, you know, classic and somewhat experimental horror tropes that are just extended, you know, over the course of a story. And when we did that SF Signal a few weeks ago, we were talking about Dan Simmons and stuff like Drood and The Terror and Abominable, where he just manages to, even though there isn't a high number of very large scares that come out and hit you, by page 100, you're in fear for your life for the rest of the book, just because he's managed to percolate such a, you know, sense of impending doom, either because of the setting or the way the characters are reacting to it.
Well, can we take a step back?
Sure.
And what is, either from you or David, what is splatterpunk? Yeah. Let's see if I can say this right. Splatterpunk. And then what is the new weird?
Okay, Dave, why don't you go first on this? Because
just some of our listeners might not know either. You know.
So. Yeah. Well, I guess for me, splatterpunk was the extremely visceral horror that emerged primarily in the late 80s, and still around a bit in the early 90s, so you had the opposition between, say, the quiet horror, which the term I think championed by Charles L. Grant, and the kind of horror that he was writing versus, it wasn't a very precisely defined movement, that's for sure, and there were different writers at different times who were categorized that way, rightly or wrongly, from their perspective. But you know, people like Barker and David Scow, who I believe coined the term.
Joe Lansdale, he got labeled that too.
Joe Lansdale, Nancy Collins, Lucy Taylor, some of her stuff. A kind of go for broke nastiness. As far as the level of violence was concerned, there tended to be the kind of the loud versus quiet controversies in horror, which I mean to a degree struck me as pointless because it's a pretty big tent.
Was it broken down by the age of the author, or I mean, given the fact that they attached punk to it. You know, cyberpunk was the young versus the older established SF writers. So was it a similar thing, a rebellion versus a style, or?
It tended to be associated with younger writers.
Okay.
Definitely. But it's, the thing is, it's also, there's a tradition right there. I mean, you go back to the 18th century and you have, Matthew Lewis, going for broke in The Monk, right? You know, and they've got scenes in there of the female characters trapped in a dungeon, going half insane with the rotting corpse of her newborn infant and worms crawling all over the place, and horrific sexual violence all over the place, and then countering that, you have Anne Radcliffe, writing The Italian, which is kind of like the PG version of The Monk, as something of a reaction to it. And then in the background, you have Saad, who kind of setting the bar for splatterpunk that arguably has yet to be surpassed. As far as the nastiness is concerned, I think there was certainly you can see a kind of rebellion there. But again, it depends on the author and whether or not they were consciously thinking that way, or if it was just what they happened to be working in.
But the thing that the reason to me I think it shares DNA with the New Weird and certainly had a footprint on it was that one of the other things that happened was it really splatterpunk delivered this level of impact, and it did so in a large fashion by sidestepping a lot of somewhat traditional tropes. I mean, to use the obvious example, you know, Barker gave us hell, but he gave us hell with a very distinct and definable identity and a hardcore set of rules, and also gave hell a degree of agency we really hadn't seen before, and dressed it all up in leather, which was certainly a splatterpunk trope. But at the same time, I think about like Richard Christian Matheson, and I think about some stuff that McCammon did, and I think about Skip and Spectre, and once again going back to Kathy Koja, and I don't really want to dump her into this particular bucket because she certainly doesn't write that stuff anymore, but the stories that she was doing at the time, you know Bad Blood and Cypher and stuff like that, those were not horror threats we had seen before, and part of, you got past the really terrifying scene, and then when the aspect of the horrific threat made itself known, that was kind of the mind blower, and suddenly a lot of the visceral stuff that we saw previous to that almost made sense because we were dealing with something so utterly otherworldly.
I think with Koja, though, also there's something something, some of the effect was separate from the visceral of the splatterpunk. I mean, the Cypher, Bad Brains, and at least as far as Skin, as I recall, were part of the Abyss line, and from Dell. And I'm trying to remember the name of the editor who was running that. But she had a pretty specific vision of horror and placed an emphasis on the psychological, and was also very deliberately avoiding the common tropes, as you were saying. So like, so there, part of that was a particular line of books, and the I mean, to what degree, or at least being shaped also by a particular editor that. That saw those books come to light, and not to say that Koja was writing to that line, but that where at least her work found a home, and that was, I think, though contemporaneous with splatterpunk, it wasn't necessarily part of it, in the same way that Skip and Spectre stuff was very central to the splatterpunk.
There were a lot of great horror imprints back then. I just remembered that. There was a lot of great lines. Skip and Spectre did that great. They edited that great line of Living Dead anthologies. That was probably the last time I dabbled in zombies.
Before the Great Revival.
Yeah. Fred, does that kind of answer the question of identity as to?
Sure, for Spatterpunk, what about the new weird? So is that like the new space opera then, reviving?
To an extent, the
horror movement.
The new weird tended to be, I heard someone describe it as secondary worlds indistinguishable from our own, which I always got a kick out of. But to me, you know, it was basically a focusing of weird fiction into slightly more personal stories than weird fiction tended to have. Sort of there was a lot of third person in weird fiction in the early days, and I think it became much more first person after that, number one. And number two, as I said before, it was something where the strangeness, where the quote-unquote weird element, was something that was not necessarily discovered over the course of the story, but was merely a aspect of this particular existence that is encountered over the course of the story. That's my take on it. I bet John probably has a slightly more accurate take on it than I do.
Maybe. Okay, well, but I mean, I think more of the fantastic roots of New Weird than the horror roots. In terms of, I mean, this is sort of the problem with genre we get into is when you, the farther you go back in history, the less clear the lines are, and multiple genres, you know, construct genealogies out of the same material as others do.
Mm.
But the new weird for me was sort of, the weird for me was kind of a response to what happened after the new wave, when there was a sort of backlash against the new wave of science fiction.
Okay.
In like the 70s and 80s, people try to get back to sort of tradition in a certain sense in some parts of the genres. And then New Weird was trying to basically respond to that and say, we don't need to go back to tradition. We can continue making new ones. And certainly postmodernism as a literary critical groundswell is part of New Weird too. I mean, Mieville is a fantastic example of that. I mean, he's so bloody steeped in postmodernism, and, you know, he's just pretty much dripping with it. I mean, not in a Derridian sense, in the sense of Derrida of complete deconstruction, but he, you know, the amount of play that New Weird does with older tropes, and not just to make exciting plots, but to actually do all kinds of literary transformations is, to me, means New Weird is sort of bigger than its horror or its fantastical roots. It's trying to do something a little more evocative.
Okay. I had not thought of that before. That's not something I'd really thought about. which that brings up another thing. What authors, mm-hmm. what horror authors, when you talk about the literary toolbox and the expansive literary toolbox, what horror authors really took advantage of that stuff? I mean, as much as I like Skip and Spectre, I don't think they did anything really experimental when it came to their writing.
You mean back then or now?
Back then and now, quite frankly. I think about like mm-hmm. John Shirley's writing and how utterly poetic certain chapters were,
mm-hmm.
even when he was delivering the scares, as opposed to someone like, you know, Robert McCammon, who was a very, I don't want to say he's a journeyman writer, because I thought he wrote excellent books, but he certainly was not trying to, you know, break any literary boundaries of the stuff he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously, Mayville's a big one. Vandermeer,
yeah,
is a really good example. I mean, in a somewhat more traditional hearkening back to stuff way, Laird Barron is a good example too.
Yes.
Alison Bird has done some really good stuff. The funny thing is, the more that I try to think about it, the more I find myself going afield with authors, and some of whom may not even think themselves as new weird necessarily, because I think we've kind of gotten to a tipping point with that term, where we're sort of heading somewhere else now. But I mean, it seems to me that more and more authors are interested in, at least folks who are sort of doing the stuff we might call new weird, are more interested in creating something that is both literary and, you know, emerges from fantastical or horror roots in a very self-conscious way. I mean, one of the things to me that makes a new weird author is that they have a certain self-consciousness about the literature they're producing. You know, so, I mean, some authors just, I mean, I've been reading a lot of stuff online about writing for the book on reading, and, you know, I'm amazed at how many writers just sort of say, yeah, I just kind of bang it out. And, you know, I'm not really conscious of what I do. It just, it happens. And it, yay, people like it.
Why are new weird authors aren't like Chuck Wendig?
No, Chuck is a pretty unique beast. He's, he's really doing his own thing. But no, I've been reading a couple of, I won't mention names, but, reading stuff by a couple of authors talking about their process, or a bunch of authors actually, now that I think about it, and in a lot of areas, like in epic fantasy areas, so many of them are specifically not self-conscious. It's almost like they're like, it happens, I write it and it happens. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of new weird authors are very self-conscious about their process. They're not just conscious about where they're coming from or the traditions they're playing with, but they're consciously trying to make something that is, in a certain sense, literary. Not as in the literary genre per se, but they're interested in, you know, the word crafting and the symbol and symbolism and the idea that they're making something, they're making an artistic object. And it's, like I said, in sort of a postmodernist way, it's sort of a commentary back on the past, too, sometimes. I mean, like Laird Barron's an interesting example because he does very visceral horror writing, really.
Yes, he does.
But there's a lot of, like, the stories that he writes are really very literarily well done. They're very precise. They're very evocative, and there's a certain self-consciousness that, as an undertone in them, about what they are and what they're trying to do. You know, they can be remarkably complex for the kind of stories that are being told on the surface. So
that's a very delicate balancing act, too, isn't it? If the story is meant to be generating fear, a very visceral reaction. If the story starts to become too self-conscious, you can wind up with a work that is very eloquent and elegant and admirable as a crafted piece of literary jewelry, but that lacks the visceral charge. That I remember reading an anthology some years back that was so concerned with, and I'm going to use here one of my most hated phrases, quote unquote, transcending the genre, that it produced a bunch of stories that that had sentences that were very well crafted from one to the next, but had zero impact. And so if what you're describing is something that where that balance has been being walked very perfectly.
Mm-hmm. And I think Baron's stuff does that, definitely. It's really, I mean, it was funny when we were talking about this topic, I was thinking, you know, I'm not really a horror person. Like, I don't think of myself as a horror fan or a reader of the horror genre. But the more I thought about this topic, the more I was starting to pull in writers that clearly do stuff that can be seen as horror, that are even called horror. But I don't think of them that way at first. It's not until I sit down and really look at the stories that I say, oh yeah, there's horror there. I mean, well, Baron's a pretty obvious example of that, but.
Well, and I think that comes back to something that, we've already mentioned a bit, the difficulty of genre definitions. I myself don't see horror as a genre. Back in the term I was using for when I was doing my thesis on it was a rhizome, but ultimately seeing it as a collection of tactics identifiable by their purpose, which is to generate horror. So it's the affect that is that they're seeking to create, and then those tactics are going to mutate over time. But the horror rhizome can be detected in any number of works, can be present to a greater or lesser degree, right? So some of what Jeff was talking about earlier, where you're seeing it there lurking in the background without necessarily being the whole story. And what the works that we tend to qualify unproblematically as horror are ones where that has now become the primary focus of the story. But you can see it operating in, say, something like a True Detective, where there's the sense of the uncanny. There's something in the background. It's a crime show, but not entirely. There's something else there, right? And that would be the horror rhizome at work. Working a little bit like a parasite on other forms, or something like Seven, which looks like it's going to be a buddy cop thriller and gets blown apart from the interior by a horror movie.
A very uncanny horror movie, like in Todorov sense, an uncanny story. Yeah.
But that's the thing. There's absolutely. I mean, one of the difficulties in trying to define horror by the actual content is that is things like you'll have the uncanny, you'll have the flat out supernatural, you have no supernatural, no fantastic whatsoever, and yet it's still horror. So I mean, I've seen some attempts at defining it that horror must be supernatural. Okay, great, you just eliminated Psycho from the proceedings. I remember reading one book that eliminated Psycho and The Fly, but included Brother from Another Planet, at which point my skeptical eyebrows were skeptical. So the form, therefore, the some of the tactics which are going to be very effective in a given era, at a given time, might define might give us something that we might want to call a genre or be tempted to call a genre for a certain period. But then it changes, the tropes might be returned to at various times. But if we look at horror starting from the Castle of Otranto to today, it's really hard to come up with a consistent set of tropes that are always going to be there. It's too multivarious, plus all the different other forms that it becomes part of, right? So you get things that people point, what to me are silly debates as to whether Alien, for example, is science fiction or it's horror, which, as I've said elsewhere, that's like trying to decide whether the sun is round or hot. it's a completely meaningless distinction there.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I'm kind of genre agnostic in the fact that I judge horror or something, I judge something as horror by its desired effect. You know?
Yeah.
So you've got Psycho, and you've got, you know, Hellraiser, and you've got, you know, all these different things that are aiming to fire the same bunch of neurons in the primate brain. And when you talk about, you know, the tropes being reused and repackaged, I mean, one of the things that I really liked the first time I read Peter Hamilton's Night's Dawn trilogy was that he kept ramping up his sense of wonder as it went. And then when stuff finally hit, you know, you finally get to the end of your great voyage towards this wonderful sense of wonder, and it comes out and bites your head off, you know. And it really added a bit of impact that he went in such a different direction before he started bringing in some of the more horrific scenes from the first book of that trilogy. Fred, what was the last real scary book?
Well, I'm going to go graphic.
Okay.
The one that you recommended to me, Caliban.
Oh, yeah.
Which definitely harkens to Alien. In that it's, you know, very science fictional. It's a big spaceship. It's got aliens that are evil and nasty, maybe. And lots of blood and lots of people getting eviscerated and dissected and modified. And so on and so forth.
For thoroughly misunderstood reasons as well. That was something else I liked about that story, was trying to figure out the motive of the threat.
Yep.
As it carried on. Yeah.
I mean, I'm more of a traditional horror person. Like every winter, I tend to, during a really good blizzard, pull out Who Goes There by John Campbell. And At the Mountains of Madness, and the one Edgar Allan Poe, Arthur Gordon Pym, you know, short novel, as well as the sort of sequel by Jules Verne. So, you know, I tend to read those just about every year during a nice windy storm, because they work so well. I mean, David knows that my preference for The Haunting is The Haunting in black and white with no blood and no special effects, and just atmosphere oozing out of every frame, versus the new one.
Is that the wrong
movie? Probably. I think we'd have to hunt far and wide for anyone who preferred the later one.
Right.
I hope.
Is that the Robert Wise movie?
Yes.
Yeah, I actually took a directing course with him out of college.
Really?
We're in Ireland, and he actually did he gave that movie a little bit of a MST3K treatment, where we watched the movie while he sat in front with a microphone and would tell us things to look for in the background, and talked about how they used a lot of infrared film on that to get some really deeper shadows on some of the house textures and things along those lines. It was quite fascinating. That is a good movie. So yeah, it's weird, because it's one of those movies that every time I watch it, I just sit there and stare at the technical values of it as opposed to what's actually going on in the film.
The funny thing with two different versions of that novel is that in the when I've taught a horror lit course as opposed to a horror film course, and we do the Haunting of Hill House, the first few years I taught it, I showed the Robert Wise film, but I've since switched over to showing the Jan de Bont film, because as dreadful as that movie is, the students come out of that much more aware of what Shirley Jackson was doing so well in the book. And whereas I found the 63 film to be, especially for first years, a harder sell, because it's in black and white, and you know, there's no big special effect moments and so forth. Whereas when I give them what they want with all the color and the special effects, and they go, wait a minute, this is terrible, and the book is doing this so much better.
Well, let me tell you a little story about that. I mean, here's the funny thing. When my daughter expressed interest in Doctor Who, I started with New Who, because it's in color. She doesn't like black and white stuff. It's color, special effects, flashbang, moves fast, whatever. She was bored. So I go, okay, fine. I pulled out an Earthly Child, black and white, slow, lots of talking, cardboard sets, and she was hooked. So you never know about these kids these days.
No, true enough.
Well, it's funny, you know, going back to the technical aspects of things, David, we tweeted back and forth a couple of weeks ago, because I saw for the first time The Monster and the Girl
on film.
On Svengoolie. And first of all, I have to express my wholesale adoration of that show, because I never got to see it until I moved to Virginia when I finally had a station that showed it. And the fact that he does, you know, the fact that he maintains everything that a horror host should do when it comes to campy comedy and stuff like that, but also the fact that he goes out of his way to kind of educate you on the origins of movies and, you know, especially when it comes to the Universal stuff, a lot of the, you know, studio politics that were involved in the making of them. But in watching that particular movie, which is a fairly ridiculous story, I sat there watching it going, this movie was beautifully made. There's a lot of like stuff that Hitchcock went on to do later. There's a lot of, you know, tracking shots. There's a lot of, you know, crazy stuff where the gorilla, there's a gorilla in it, where the gorilla is walking along the rooftops and the camera is tracking him, looking down at the guy he's following on the street below. There's a lot of, you know, I remember watching the documentary on how Harold Lloyd made all his movies and some of the crazy perspective tricks that he would do to make things look, you know, scarier than they actually were, or more, you know, more unusual than they actually were. And I saw a lot of those at work in the movie. And, it was one of those things that when it finally got around to one of the actual killings, I was like, okay, get done with the killing. Go back to the lead up to the killing, because that's the real interesting part to watch. You know, that's the bit that I really want to get through, which I guess kind of plays off something what John said about the, you know, the craft that's involved, because I've certainly felt that in books as well, where I go, wow, this is a beautiful chapter. And then at the end, you know, somebody's arm gets ripped off and you're like, oh, okay. I forgot. We're supposed to be here to get scared.
and that is definitely the greatest film noirish take on brains being transplanted into gorillas.
Yes.
I have to. My favorite line in that film is, "I don't want to be mangled," which, yeah, you know, that's art.
Oh, who does?
I think my favorite line is every bone in his body was broken. Well, what did it? And the doctor goes, hey, I just find him dead. You guys have to go solve the murder. Yeah, scary, scary movies. I haven't really watched many lately. I mean, aside from the ones I've seen on Svengoolie and a few others that have been on TCM lately. But when it comes to the films that you're teaching, aside from what your favorites are there any that get really good reactions out of the class?
For horror?
Yeah, for horror.
Well, it depends on the context in which I'm teaching them. But one of the ones that I've, when I do film history, that I've been consistently pleased with the response to is the 1931 Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Robin Williams one, where the Frederick March's transformation into Hyde still astonishes them. Mm-hmm. The first transformation scene where, like, you see the makeup just seamlessly begins to appear as they remove the filters from the camera and the previously applied makeup became visible. So yeah, I mean that film always seems to go over well. I have to say for the more horror oriented courses, which ones are the particular favorites, I'd have to cast my mind back. Maybe ask me again next year. I'm going to be doing going to be teaching the European horror film again. Ooh. And so looking forward to that. I think certainly the some of the responses to the Mario Bava and some of the sort of peak period Argento that we've looked at have gone over well.
As well it should. Yeah, remember when TV ads for movies used to scare the pants off you?
Yes.
That was such a time. I remember the Behind the Door. Was that the movie? The commercial had the set of drawers with the drawers are flying in and out back and forth and the doors are all slamming. They didn't show anybody. It was just showed all the furniture being moved around. Terrified me.
Well, I remember being terrified by the commercial for the Evil, which, I mean, it's a pretty silly movie. Yeah. As delightful as Victor Buono as Satan is, but at the right age, the commercials for Beyond the Door, the Evil, the Sentinel, all of those were absolutely terrifying. But of course, it was the age too.
Yeah, I miss those days. Every commercial is so freaking over the top and drives me nuts.
Well, it seems to, I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen the commercials for, was it a Ouija board or whatever?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Like, oh, gee, look at that trope. Look at that trope. oh, look, they're rolling the eyes up. Well, we haven't seen that a million times.
You might want to check out the trailer for the Babadook. That's looking quite promising.
Haven't seen that yet. Okay.
That's an Australian film, I believe, and very much looking forward to catching that one.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. John, what's the last scary thing you read?
Probably when I read The Children of Old Leech a couple of months ago, the tribute volume to Laird Barron.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, we read a few of the stories today, sort of preparing for for this. I'd have a little bit of something fresh in my head that I could talk about, and it actually, I think, exemplifies some of the things I was talking about earlier about, you know, it's billed as horror essentially, but also the editor Ross Lockhart is someone who's known for bizarro, new weird, mm-hmm. and sort of more literary sort of varietals of fantastic fiction, so. I think that's the last, you know, thing. And in terms of being scary, it's more that it, you know, sort of the more classical, you know, creates dread. So clearly coming from, you know, inspired by Laird Barron's work, it's sort of both horror and, you know, something more philosophically troubling, perhaps, and, you know, as like I said, in terms of being scary, I don't know if it's scary as much as, you know, you get a really palpable sense of dread from some of the stories. And you become concerned for the human race at a few times, too, given the behavior of some of the characters. So, but, I mean, also thinking about what we were talking about, and I was talking about earlier about New Weird, I mean, in a weird way, Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation is kind of a horror story, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's just very, very naturalized. Like, the horror isn't jump scares or, you know, the monster that ate Sheboygan or anything like that. It's very subtle and the dread and the fear, the scares are really integrated into the story itself. So, like, not so much like what Jeff was talking about in terms of being in the background. It's right up front. But it's... In a lot of horror, the horror is something that comes from outside into our world in a way that makes it seem like a break with reality. Whereas in Vandermeer, in Annihilation, it's like reality is changing and these weird things are happening as a result.
Yeah.
So nature is reforming itself or new things are happening, but they're not some kind of, you know, totally alien thing. They're weird to humans and... They have unforeseen effects, but somehow they become, you know, part of the landscape, part of the world. Which to me can be really effective in terms of horror because, you know, you see characters doing things you wouldn't expect people to do or see them make observations that seem very bizarre but seem natural to them or things like that. That can be very effective as sort of a way to project horror, certainly. So,
you know, something else I was thinking about as we were prepping for this was that I was, you know, going through my collection as I was organizing books, and I was looking at how many, like, you know, James Herbert and Bentley Little books I have sitting around, and it sort of dawned on me, you don't see the racks full of, I really hate to call these people mid-listers because they're authors who I really, really like and who made a fairly good living doing this, but you really don't see that anymore. You don't see the everyday publication of horror, as often as you as we used to in the past.
That's true of just about every genre at this point. Yeah. So many. So, I mean, the mid list has been eviscerated so many times, so many places.
Yeah.
And horror is. I mean, it's around in a way that, or at least it's. It, again, it's not as bad as it was in the 90s. It still is a long way from, when those books were commonplace. Yeah. But we do have at least a lot of, one of the reasons you don't see them is some of the presses that put them out there. I mean, like Leisure Books was one of the ones who was most prolific, and not for the authors you mentioned specifically, but the racks would be filled with their stuff, and they've that imprint collapsed, and with all the there's all kinds of bad business still going around with the issues surrounding Dorchester, but there is at least a lot of the smaller imprints that are there. Some of the writers who were present there then are still active. It's just in with a lot of smaller presses now.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to poke into that.
But yeah, it's been hard for the midlist.
Yeah, I also kind of miss the epic horror that we used to get, like Carrie and Comfort and Ghost Story, books like that. I can't think of the last time I read a really good ensemble, large-scale horror story like that. Certainly there are some kicking around.
Well, World War Z would be probably fall into that category, right, broadly speaking? Yeah. I mean, you've got the ensemble, you've got the epic sweep.
All right.
I think, but you're right that it's certainly not. I mean, that's something I remember primarily from the early 80s.
Yeah.
Early to mid.
Yeah.
I have some plans that way myself, but that's down the road.
But what authors have you been reading, David? I don't want to jump into culture consumed yet, but which authors have been on your radar lately, horror-wise?
I was going to be saving that for precisely the culture consumed. Horror-wise, I mean, it's been... Yeah, my reading has been curtailed by the in volume by the numbers, but by the writing. But actually, I mean, Susan Hill has definitely been one that I've been enjoying immensely, as far as full on horror is concerned. And also, I had certainly over the summer had a lot of fun with Hunter Shea's The Montauk Monster, because I'm going to be a sucker for any book that just throws a bunch of monsters at me and eats a lot of people. there's nothing wrong with that.
Wow. Okay. Well, if anyone has anything else to add on the subject of horror. If not, we can certainly start talking about what we've been dabbling in these past few weeks. Fred, why don't you start?
Oh, boy. We could be here all night.
I know.
Once again, we will provide links to my blog, where I've gone from last month had read 88 books. Now I'm up to 104, 105. And short stories, last month I was at 719, and I'm afraid I'm only up to 782, so slowing down, yes, exactly. Television, pretty much only television I watch is Doctor Who and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and I must say both of them have been excellent this year. I don't know if that's widely felt or I'm just an aberration, but...
I would agree with you.
I've enjoyed both immensely.
I will have a rebuttal when it's my turn.
Okay, then. Books. I think some of this might leak into what I mentioned either on our show or on the last FSF Signal that I participated in. But I read the collected Age of Ultron.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I ranted about that on here. Mm-hmm. Avengers Assemble, Avengers Volume 1 by Brian Michael Bendis.
Right.
I found this place called The Library. I don't know if you guys ever heard of it.
Yeah.
They actually have hardcover comic books there. So I've taken out a couple of piles, and I've I've actually tweeted the pictures of the pile, so you can see what I'm reading. Ed Brubaker, another more comics. The Marvels Project, which I guess I call that rebooting it from World War II.
Yeah.
And you had not only some superheroes or people with superpowers, but you had even some regular guys that just wore capes and masks and fought crime with their fists and their brains. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of an interesting book. Captain America Winter Soldier. Still haven't seen the movie, but now I've at least read a comic with the same name. Whether it's the same story, I'll find out down the road. And then my brain nearly exploded when I read something called Deadpool Volume 1. And that was quite an experience. I've never read any other Deadpool before, and I'm still debating whether I'll read any more, because that was just like, okay then, you know.
Yeah, they've plugged him into just about every book that's come out lately.
Yeah. I mean, you know, having the ghost of Ben Franklin and every single dead president running around, that was okay. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry because it was just so weird.
Yeah, he's got a crossover book with Hawkeye that's on its second issue, I think.
Yeah, I've bought those, so yeah, I guess I will be reading more Deadpool. And then revisiting a subject from one of our prior episodes, I read Global Frequency by Warren Ellis. I don't know, is that his tribute to International Rescue or what?
That and a little bit of Mission Impossible, but I think he was modernize things as much as he could. It was to make the organization as social as it could be. So,
and the funny thing though was, in many ways, it's aged less gracefully as far as technology is concerned than, say, International Rescue.
Yes, it has.
You look at the cell phone, I'm like, well, you know, you can do a lot more nowadays. And just imagine if your 1001 agents were all on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an account I follow, a guy named Brown Moses, who does deep analysis with crowds on pictures coming out of the Middle East, for example, where somebody will say, oh, look, it's a Syrian anti-aircraft missile, and there are five people, including me, will chime in saying, no, that's actually a 105-millimeter tank thing. main gun round from a tank. So,
yeah, Ellis has bad luck when it comes to technology outstripping him. I mean, the same thing went with Transmetropolitan. I mean, you know, he finished that series when social media was just really starting to ramp up, and the whole idea of 24/7 news and immersive news and, you know, news/commentary being a constant thing and stuff like that really took off and outstripped, you know, what he had in that book shortly after he did it. So,
yeah, but I think I liked Transmetropolitan better, even though the predictions might have been off.
Yeah.
I don't know whether because it was more satire. You know, just like I like Max Headroom even now better than, say, a serious approach to the news or news prediction. So maybe that's what saved Transmetropolitan for me. Mm. And then I am continuing my quest to get ready for HonorCon 2014 when a little less than 2 weeks from now I get in the car and drive to North Carolina, one state closer than last year. And so I've read Worlds of Honor, Changer of Worlds, In Fireforge, Beginnings. Those are all short story collections. War of Honor, which might be the longest of his books in the series. And then a collaboration called Crown of Slaves, which he wrote with Eric Flint. And I'm almost done with another one called In the Shadow of Saganami. Mm. So whether I finish the entire series before I get in the car, I don't know. But I'll die trying. So that's why I haven't read too much horror, because I've been reading a lot of space opera.
That's a legitimate reason.
Yep, and that is it. I know I'm slacking, but that's it.
Yeah. So, John, what's been on your plate?
In terms of reading, I haven't done this quite as much as usual. I finished Jeff Enderman's Annihilation. I actually reread it. I read it twice. Because I read it the first time, I wanted to go back and sort of go through it more slowly, because there was a lot of interesting stuff going on, and I had in the back of my head this weird contrasting of it with Bennett's City of Stairs in terms of the theory of reality that governs each book. They're just very different, and it was so stark to me that I had to go play with it for a while. So I spent way a lot of time on that. And obviously I liked the book if I went back and read it again.
I read it three times this year.
I mean, you know, some books get hype and I want to throw them through a window, but this was not one of those books. I'm a big, as people probably know, I'm a big Vandermeer fan, and I appreciate what he tries to do with his fiction and the way and his writing style is totally, you know, it has some resonance with it that I like to try to write, and it's great stuff. So I haven't gotten the other two books yet because I'm really poor right now, but I'm working on it, and I'm hoping to read the whole trilogy and write something about it. And then in terms of other fiction, I mean, I reread, like I said, some of the Children of Old Leech stories today in that collection, and I do recommend that collection. Some of the stories fell a little flat for me. Others were fine. And a few of them were, like I said, made me question, you know, my humanity, in a interesting way. But I've actually been doing, for some reason, doing a lot more TV watching the past few weeks. I had started watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. when it first came out, and then I stopped after episode 3 because it was terrible. It was just terrible. But someone loaned me the first season, to watch, so I sort of caught up on it in like a week and a half, watching a couple episodes a day, and it got better. And I liked the second half of the season much better than the first. And I've started actually watching the second season online. ABC TV has been putting some of the episodes up. And I'm a little disappointed. I was going to, in terms of my rebuttal to, you know, Fred saying that he liked it so much. I'm not sure the second season is really delivering on the promise of the first season's ending yet. And I'll compare that with Arrow, which I've just caught up on, too, because it's now on Netflix, the first and second seasons. That's another show. I'd watched most of the first season and had been kind of troubled because there's some things that are really interesting, and then there's some things that seem like One Life to Live. I mean, you know, rich people with romantic problems and, you know, schemers and it was really trying to walk this sort of line, it seemed, in a very knowing way between a TV soap opera and an attempt at a TV superhero, you know, show. And sometimes it succeeded and sometimes it didn't. But then I caught the second season, and that tension is still there. But I thought there was actually a little more grit in the acting and a little more of an interesting plot developing. The only thing that really bugs me about Arrow is that Oliver's the whiniest superhero ever. And that's saying a lot. Superheroes are whiny.
Yep.
But he is the whiniest superhero ever. He's like, I stubbed my toe. I can never be Arrow again. That's what it felt like. That's kind of what I've been doing for culture consumption. I mean, the TV shows took up a fair amount of my free time, and I have less free time now because I'm actually trying to work and do other things as well. So my summer of, you know, enforced leisure from the surgery has given way to real life, and my time is becoming more precious, but I am. But I've been looking at, you know, TV, like I said. I mean, I also saw the first two episodes of The Flash. And as I think I tweeted, what really gets me about is that Grant Gustin is really cute, and he's really a very good Flash, I think. But the show so telegraphs every single thing like it beats you over the head with this, you know, this character's feeling this. This is a significant plot point. Look, see where the lights and the arrows are pointing? Significant plot point. Just the all that obviousness just really is starting to bug me, so I may not continue with that. But at the same time, like I said, I think Grant Gustin is very good as the Flash. And I think he has a shot at actually developing a character here, but I don't know if the script will actually let him.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't bring myself to watch either of those shows. I really can't. So. Yeah, it's just too rough for me. So, David, what have you been occupying your time with?
Well, as far as the books are concerned, actually just started actually reading to my mother Nagao Marsh's Artists in Crime, which is one of her Detective Allen books, and as ever, just so impressed by her command of voice, the wit of the prose, but just getting very distinct voices for all of her characters, just the tight construction of her books. So really enjoying that. And in a related vein, I just read Murder on the Titania by one of my Skiffy and Fanti co-hosts, Rachel Axe, and that's a Marsh-like murder mystery set, but in a steampunk setting, in an alternate history United States, and taking place on a Zeppelin. So that, and that, I thought that was huge fun. I'm currently reading Teresa Frohawk's novella, The Broken Road, and I'm really fascinated by some of what she is doing in bringing full-on horror into a kind of high fantasy setting. So I'm really liking what I'm seeing there. A couple of nonfiction mentions. I've just been reading. Read recently James Walter's fantasy film introduction, since I'm teaching the course. And one of the things that struck me is when he talks about the difficulty in defining fantasy as a genre. I thought, okay, well, this is a familiar problem. And then referring to the difficulty in defining it, as opposed to such much more solidly and easily definable genres as science fiction and horror. And so that made me laugh, but also think that the more involved one is with any one of these categories, the more difficult they clearly become to define. And one that I keep sort of jumping into because it's both a pleasure, but it's such a gigantic tome, and I haven't had time to read it all through yet, is Stephen Thrower's Nightmare USA, The Untold Story of the Exploitation Independence. And this is a gigantic, loving examination of the sort of low-budget horror films in primarily the 70s and into the mid-80s. And it's promised to be just the first of two volumes. Wow. And I think it's already one of the most important studies of horror film in the last decade or so. Movie-wise, the last thing I saw in the theaters was As Above, So Below, which on a budget and the inevitable found footage approach manages to give us both a kind of a neat low-budget evocation of hell, in a way that reminds me of some of the European horror films from the 70s or 80s, particularly had some of the vibe of Pupi Avati's Revenge of the Dead or Zadar. And at the same time, also giving us the best version of Tomb Raider that we're likely to get for some time in film. So that was, it's not perfect, but I thought it was a lot of fun. Some of the recent rewatches I've been able to do because of the fantasy film course just in the last few weeks have been Jason and the Argonauts, the Harryhausen film, Diimagine, from 1966, and Jean Cocteau's Orpheus, which I think a lot of urban fantasy, knowingly or not, owes a great deal to. I mean, it's here we go, 1950 with Death riding around on motorcycles, or well, at least in a Rolls Royce, in a contemporary setting. TV-wise, my wife and I just caught up on the most recent season of Castle, and we are embarked on Penny Dreadful. We're about three episodes in, so you know, my full jury's still out. But so far, I've been quite delighted by what seems like, again, one of those all-too-rare successful creations of horror in on television. And the announced Universal Monsterverse, which I have grave doubts about, is sure going to have to work very hard to do something better than what I've seen this series do so far. Penny Dreadful?
No, the Monsterverse.
Oh, they're trying to mimic the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay.
By having a bunch of interconnected films, and what they're drawing on is
the
classics. So Frankenstein Monster, Dracula, The Mummy, The Wolfman, The Creature from the Black Lagoon. They've actually used the term, what was it? Something dreadful like all-out action thrillers or something like that. So it's like, okay, so you really have no sense of what those original movies were like. Wow. Do you? I think that the model is the Stephen Sommers Mummy films. Van Helsing. I'm very concerned about that. In fact, Dracula Untold, they did some reshoots of that to make it as a kind of prologue to the Monsterverse. Though I guess they have an out if the movie bombs, which I believe it has. I think the first entry is going to be another Mummy film a rebooted Mummy film in 2017, I think. Anyway, I hope I'm wrong in expecting this to be horrifically bad, but I won't be at all surprised if it is. And Penny Dreadful, I think, is showing how it could be done. Mm-hmm. At least in what I've seen so far, really like what they've done with Frankenstein and the monster. I get the hints of what they're going to be doing so far with Dorian Gray is looking very promising. Now, who knows? Those people who have seen the full season may tell me I'm wrong in where this is going, but certainly the first three episodes have been very promising. And then just today, I picked up. I'm working to complete my collection of Jack Kirby's bizarre 2001: A Space Odyssey series.
Oh boy!
So yeah, I only ever had the first issue, which I actually I bought when it first came out, and saw shortly before my father took me to see the movie. And so I was very confused at first because the movie didn't resemble at all what I'd read, and I'd always wondered how the rest of it had gone. So I was at my comic book store today, and he's got most of the rest of the series. So I'm still missing issues 4 and 5, but I've got everything else now.
Yeah, that's a weird book. Yeah. It's funny. I have a vague memory, I want to say about 8 or 9 years ago, that I don't even remember who the publisher was, started putting out a series of novels that was based on the Universal Monsters. I think Paul DeFilippo did the...
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah,
that's the only one I saw in that. That's still sitting on my shelf waiting for me to read it. But
he read from that at ReaderCon, and I remember him telling us the whole plan for this series of books. And I said, "Oh, that's awesome!" And then I don't remember hearing anything else after that. So,
yeah, I certainly don't recall seeing anything.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, what he read, it was really good. I never read the book, but he read about 1,000 words, and it was awesome. So.
The Creature from the Black Lagoon is one that they keep trying to reboot decade after decade, and so far we've been lucky in that they failed to do so. I tend to agree with Joe Dante that the monster suit in the first film is really unimprovable.
Yeah,
and I think also that film was a product of the '50s, mm-hmm. and I exactly. don't. You know, the sensibility of it, the tensions that are created there, I don't think you could do it again
yeah.
without
right.
Ending up with something truly bad.
It's funny because I think it was July or August, Spengulli showed all the creature films. Mm. And as he was showing the first one, I pulled out the adaptation that Arthur Adams had done, the comic artist Arthur Adams. And it's funny because there's a writer credit on there. I forget who the writer credit is, but it isn't the person who wrote the movie. And you're reading the comic, and it's literally just line for line. They just lifted the script and plugged it into these word balloons. And I was like, wow, someone got a writer credit for doing that. Amazing. But I love Arthur Adams' adaptation of it. It was really good.
Dreamhaven Books just republished the tie-in novel that for the first film that came out in England in the 50s.
Mm. Oh. Wow. Yeah, and those, you know, like you said, you know, trying to recapture that because those sequels did go downhill really fast, you know. So, well, last weekend I went up to Gaithersburg, Maryland for Capclave. And met up with our friend Jamie Tadrubin, and he introduced me to Bud Sparhawk, and I went to a panel that they did on online writing tools. And Chris Weave, who Fred introduced me to, I went to his panel that he moderated on Space War, and spent a lot of time in the dealer's room, and basically spent a day and a half just immersing myself in convention, which I haven't had a chance to do all that often. But that was really fun. One of the things I picked up while I was down there was Upgraded, the new anthology by Neil Clark, which is all about cybernetics. And I'm about halfway through that, and that's been really good so far. I also picked up an ebook of David Gatewood's Robot Chronicles anthology, which just came out. I think it just came out. I don't think it was this summer. I think it was like the last couple of weeks. And it's got a Yuhaui story and a Nina Croft story. I've read those so far, and those are really good. So I'm diving into those. My pickup when I have a free moment book right now is Nature's Features 2, which is all the little four-page stories that run in the back of Nature. This is the second collection of them, and it's really good. And our friend Matthew Sanborn Smith has a story in this second collection, and I'm going to be mentioning Matthew again in a moment when I talk about something else. And I just finished Conservation of Shadows, the Yun Ha Lee collection, which I just adored. I just loved it. Most of those stories I had not read, and it was wonderful. Genre entries in my list this week. Number one, Into the War by Italo Calvino, which I read for no reason whatsoever, except I had a copy and I read it. And I really, really liked it. I'd never read that before. And I also read the science book God in the Multiverse by Victor Stenger, which was basically, it's basically a very long treatise against the concept that the universe was finely tuned by God. I read it for the sole reason that Victor Stenger, who spent a great deal of time poking at bees' nests, wrote a book describing how, in fact, the universe and the theory of the multiverse explicitly proves that there is not a loving, caring God. And then 3 days before it got published, he died. So it was the Terry Pratchett moment for me, and I had to read the book just to see what was going on. A couple other things, Sister Noon by Karen Joy Fowler, which I had never read. I really liked. I went and read the two Under the Poppy books by Kathy Koch. Her Husband's Hands by Adam Troy Castro, another book I had never read. And knocked all those out. Comic-wise, couple things. Top of my list, Birthright by Joshua Williamson and Andre Bresson. First issue came out. Young boy's playing ball with his father, goes into the woods, gets taken away to a strange and marvelous land. And the first half of the book is basically the family's implosion after their child goes missing. The
other son that they have sort of grows up with a bunch of regret. The mother and father learn to hate each other. And then about two-thirds of the way through the book, the son comes back and he's been off on a magical adventure. And he shows up basically looking like Conan the Barbarian, sitting in the police interrogation room because they found him in the exact same spot he vanished from. And the father recognizes him immediately. And we also learn by the end of the issue that something else very strange is going on between these two worlds. But as a personal tragedy type story, it was really good. As you know, a really good telling mm-hmm. happens to a family after a child goes away on a magical adventure. Really sharp book. Red Sonja, Black Tower by Frank Thierry, really good. Matt Wagner is doing Grendel versus the Shadow. Two issues have come out so far. They have been excellent. I also like Joe Harris is writing the new Alice Cooper comic, which is taking a distinctly more non-ironic horror take than I expected. I've been really liking it. And Steve Niles is doing a book with Damian Worm called The October Faction. First issue came out, some kind of creepy gothic stuff with a strange family. Highly recommend it. But Ryan Brown is writing and drawing a comic called God Hates Astronauts. And there are two issues out. And the only way I can describe it is if somebody took a really good artist and had him transcribe everything that comes out of Matthew Sanborn Smith's brain. That's the only way I can describe it. It is that crazy. The commander of the spaceship in the first issue's name is General Tiger Eating a Cheeseburger, and he is a tiger eating a cheeseburger in a military outfit flying up. I don't know, sorry. And that is one of the less bizarre aspects of it. Really been liking it. And the only TV that I've added to my list and that has not been mentioned is that our local PBS station started showing the series Vicious, which came out, I think, last year, which was the Ian McKellen, Derek Jacobi series, where they play an aging gay couple in England. And I am told, I have not seen the episode yet, but one of the things that Ian McKellen's character makes mention of is the fact that he is he once had a guest spot on Doctor Who, and he keeps trying to milk that as his claim to fame. Well, apparently there is an episode later on where he actually ends up going to a fan convention. So it's Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi at a fan convention, not playing themselves, but playing these other characters. Very much looking forward to that. Wow. Yeah, and that's about it. That's about it for me. That was awesome. David, I was very glad, very happy to have you on.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, it's been great. Yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Great talk. Listen to him on our Hated Enemy podcast. And nonsense. We love them. We love everybody over there. So, all right. Anyone
else? It's that Galactic Suburbia podcast we hate.
Huh?
It's the Galactic Suburbia podcast we hate.
Splitters.
Nonsense. We love everybody. It's the books we criticize.
Yes.
You go.
I think we have bad-mouthed a couple podcasts in the past, but they were specific things. They weren't discussion podcasts.
Usually when Patrick Hester's involved.
Yeah, that's normally true.
Yeah.
You have to do that. Yeah, when I made my trip to South Carolina a couple weeks ago, I popped in the episode that you were on, Fred.
Oh, boy.
I'm looking at the clock, and I'm going, it's 6:30 in the morning. Why am I listening to Patrick and Fred argue? I go, this is not the thing I need to be waking up to. I need something lighter for the trip. So, all right, so this was excellent. We are going to be back next month. We are putting our schedule together now for the next few months, what we are going to be doing. And I hope everybody has an excellent and scary Halloween and stay safe out there and have a good evening.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you. Happy Halloween.